the Buddha, this is the Dharma, this is the Sangha. This next chapter, which is on the second column, is one that we won't get through today. Won't get to in one day. It's one I think is one of the most important and one that I find amazingly helpful. I emphasized in my last talk, and I've been trying to emphasize throughout, that although the way in which these teachings were given in Urmeser's experience is something that's very rare, the teachings themselves are not something that's rare. They're just pure Buddhism and very deeply comprehended. And Buddhism is an incredibly pragmatic religion. The Buddha was, found what worked for him dealing with the problem of suffering, and did his best to communicate about that, and refused to get into areas that weren't conducive to the kind of religious practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. And Rinpoche Master was like that too. As I've said many times, Rinpoche Master did not speculate about things. She spoke from experience. And she said that her books were a roadmap. She meant us to be able to use these teachings. The teaching of the second column is immensely useful teaching for ordinary human beings, not great saints. I mean, I hope they find it helpful too. But us ordinary people, we're trying to put the Buddha's teaching into practice in order to get some help. This chapter, one of the reasons it's so helpful is that Rinpoche Master describes how she uses the second column, the teaching of the second column, to go right in there and deal with a problem of deep suffering right on the spot. So this is called the second column, the cleansing water of the spirit. The cleansing water of the spirit. She says, go in and out. That's in quotes. Go in and out. I was told this when I saw the five branches of the diamond scepter. I did not fully understand the importance of this at the time. So now she's really going to understand it more deeply. She says, there have been those in these last few weeks who have been horrified by what I have told them. There have been those who have sworn that I am ruining the teachings. Those who have gone away, how sad I am for them. For days and days I grieved until my sickness came back. And then I went again into meditation, even deeper than ever before. Go in. Take refuge in pure meditation when you're really up against it. She's really suffering here. So I just want to talk a bit about the way she's suffering. I've experienced some of this myself. But people get funny ideas about Zen masters and religious teachers and often project a lot of things onto them, and often fail to project onto them the fact that actually they're human beings with human feelings, and that they wouldn't be doing this if they didn't love people. And I never knew anyone who loved people as Rinpoche Master loved people. certainly knew it. I know people who love them as she loves them, but I didn't know anyone. I never knew anyone who loved them more and more purely, in a more pure way. And at this time, a number of her most senior, most deeply trusted disciples, some of the people closest to her, all in a period of just really a couple, 3 weeks, as I remember it, they bailed out and said these things. And some went out and actually spread their doubts to others and caused them to turn away from her master's teaching. Which is a real shame, you know. They could have at least kept it to themselves. But and then those other people made their choices. They could have actually just checked in with her master and come seen her, but they didn't. And I think she just must have, you know, she's incredibly grieved. She was very familiar with, you know, disciples coming and going. But at this time of all times, when she is just laying her heart open to us and showing us the finest way, and then to have it thrown back in her face, you know, it's a... And to see people who she hoped could follow her to the eternal turn away from it when some of them were undoubtedly very close. This was a time when people were getting kenshos, starting to. Remesser Daiswi, who was with her in the Bay Area, had had his kensho down there. And now a second individual had a kensho around this time, I think before these people left, but right around this time. Then I was the third, and I was in another couple months from here. And then there was more down the line in the next couple years. It was a remarkable time, and it was, for many of us at times, really scary. I mean, everything we think we knew was kind of going out the window, it seemed. You had no way of having to start all over. And really, you just had to trust like crazy. I've talked about this. It's understandable that some people would bail out then, not thinking badly of them. River Master wasn't thinking badly of them. She was grieving for them. As for you grieve for someone you love who's died. And so being the person she was, she took it to the eternal in meditation. So there's the first thing. There's a hymn, Christian Protestant hymn I learned, take your burdens to the Lord and leave them there. Well, she took this burden of sorrow, deep pain. You know, grief, we often underestimate just how painful grief is. But let me tell you, grief is the deepest spiritual pain. Now, there's really the two deepest spiritual pains. One of them is grief, and the other one is the feeling that goes, the kind of despair that goes with a conviction that one is totally unworthy of the love of God. And of course, they're really two aspects of the same thing at the deepest level. That's the darkest grief there is. But all separation from those we love, can trigger grief. And especially when we see those we love going off into folly, it can really make us grieve. She says, for days and days I grieved until my sickness came back. And that was, I think, the signal. Man, you reached the limit. It's one thing to be grieving for those you love. It's another thing to kill yourself out of it. So then she says, I went into meditation again, even deeper than before, and now I know the use of these five branches, and I know so much more besides. She's emphasized to know, now I know the use. She says, I went into meditation in the midst of this deep pain and sorrow, and I found again the truth for myself. And that's how it's done. You know, it's another thing, you know, people think, well, the Zen masters had this great enlightenment, and now they're kind of sitting here dispensing wisdom, and you get these, you know, the iconography often seems to support that, the serene Buddha, you know, dispensing the wisdom, and I know that happens, but, you know, the serene Buddha is also a human being who may be serene one moment and deeply disturbed another, deeply distressed another, and it's what a person does then that is the training, you know. It's what you do. And here the Zen master goes into deep meditation and again finds the truth, another gem of the truth. She says, grieving over the loss of these disciples, I ask the Lord deeply, what is the mistake I have made? What harm I have done? Please show me if I have done harm, for indeed I intend none. And she says, and we, I think she must have had a bunch of some people with her, at least one other person, and asking these questions, you know, really asking these questions in meditation. She says, and we were told that the answer was to be found in the five branches of the diamond scepter, the five columns of light, you know, the five aspects of deep meditation, true meditation, the five aspects of the monk, as she calls it. And she says, and I knew that it was within the second column. This is it. Then I knew, not we, but I. It was shown her. She gets some help zeroing in, and then she goes right to it. She's drawn right to it. Go to that second column. Okay, what is the teaching there? She says, for the Lord indeed does care for all his beings. It is not for me to usurp the place of the Lord. Here's the first thing about that grief here, the first truth she's hitting about it that's essential. I am not God. I cannot do another's karma, I cannot do another's training for him or her. I do not make that person's karma. It's like the Eternal saying, whoa, wait a minute. It's okay to ask, what harm have I done? Remember, you know, you are not making these people's choices for them. They're adults, they're making their choices. You've offered the truth. You haven't forced it on us. He wasn't forcing it on us. We're always free to leave any time we wanted. That was always understood, always made explicit. You're a volunteer at all times. It wasn't being forced on anyone. If you're here, it's presumed you want to receive the teaching. So, it's, you know, she's not responsible for the fact that people leave. And that then she was later, you know, and that they leave in a state of considerable doubt and confusion, and then some of them went to spread the doubt. Made a ripe little mess when one individual went back to England. I am not God, she's saying. I am not the Eternal. I am not Kanzeon. I cannot do another's training for them. So the first part of the teaching to help this grief is, you know, accept your limits. So you're not responsible for what others do. You're only responsible for what you do. That's Buddhism. And it doesn't end there. Well, then she says, that they come or go or come is not my problem. That they stay is not my problem. If they turn away from me, the Lord still does not turn away from them. If I feel anguish at their loss, it's because there is in me still some clinging, and herein lies the use of the second column, the washing in eternal love. God, this is so helpful. This is helpful for anyone I mean, it's helpful in an immense range of ways, but let's just talk about separation from those we love for a moment. It is so helpful. When any of us dies, we're separating from those we love. We're not separating from love itself, with the capital L, because we all live within that, whether we're aware of it or not. We all live within the context of the love of the eternal. The love of the eternal is the true reality of everything. And at the level of our separateness, all is different. We do have to separate from one another one day. So if you're the dying person, you're separating from those you love. You're leaving them. And if you're the person who someone you love is dying, you know, you're also being separated from them. It's a mutual separation. The same is true when you leave someone you love. Say you visited someone you love. From time to time I visit my mother who's still alive, and you know, when I leave her, I know I may never see her again. So how do we deal with the pain of this? You know, to recognize the limits of our separateness. You know, that we are, in one sense, separate. The all is different. To recognize that. And then to remember that the separation is a separation in appearance only. That the love of the eternal never abandons anyone, nor turns away from anyone, no matter what anyone does. Therefore, that separation that we sometimes feel so strongly is a separation in appearance, not in ultimate reality. Because I'm there in that love, you're there in that love, that's true whether you're alive or dead, here or there, it doesn't matter. But how do we know that in our blood and bones and in our human experience? How do we come to know that? Then you have the teaching of the second column. She says, I offer up both them and me into this column. I watch them washed within this luminescent water of the Spirit. This is how you do it. In the context of meditation, take that lump of pain and take that person or event, whatever it is that is the seeming cause of the pain, that is associated with the pain, and take yourself as you know you, take the three of them together, like put them in your spiritual hands and place them on the altar of the heart. Place them on the altar of the heart, turn them over into the much greater hands of the eternal. Like that hymn says, take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. There's another verse in the Bible I remember, or a verse in the Bible I remember, casting all your cares upon Him, for He cares for you. And, you know, this is not unique to Buddhism. It's what works. It's what people have found works. And you can do this with any pain, any need. The first column was where you turn towards the eternal. You turn towards meditation as the answer. You turn towards the eternal. And you call out for help. And you enter meditation there. That's why the first column she called eternal meditation. The second column is being washed in the water of the Spirit, in the water of the love of the eternal. Well, if we want to get something washed there, we got to put it there. If you remember the five aspects of meditation that came up for me in 98, the first is ask sincerely. The second is offer wholeheartedly. When I did those talks, by the way, and these teachings just kind of came out of me at the time, my brain was turned off. It wasn't functioning there. I sat down in meditation, and these things came out of my mouth that I'd never heard before. And at the time, I didn't know it was the five columns. But it's the same teaching. Ask sincerely. That's our position in the first column. Offer wholeheartedly. That's our position in the second column. Just two aspects of one flow of meditation, one flow of the heart, one turning to the eternal for help. And I know this works with regard to, I've experienced the same things he's talking to with regard to, people leaving. I love my disciples. When a disciple leaves, I experience grief. And this is what works. This is what works for me. It works for her. And when I follow her teaching, I always find, well, Reverend Master's teaching works for me too. Isn't that great? And it works for everything else as well. While you are holding it, as it were, up to the eternal in meditation, you may still be hurting like the Dickens for a while, by the way, because it kind of bears the pain for you to kind of more deeply experience for a while. But it also allows that water of the compassion of the eternal, the love of the eternal, to get at that need. You might say that the junction point, if you look at the picture associated with this, is a person standing within the knot of eternity, in the water of the Spirit, within the water of the Spirit. And you could say that the knot of eternity is kind of, she used to talk about it as being kind of right at the hara, and it's kind of like you've brought it, the need up to the hara into meditation, and it's sitting there in the hara, on the altar of the heart, the spiritual heart, the heart with a capital H. And there, the water of the eternal compassion and love and wisdom gets at it there. And so even if it's painful, sit with that pain when you meditate. I don't like pain myself. I'm a real chicken about pain. But it's the only thing that I've ever found that works. Eventually, you got to bring that need to the eternal and put it on the altar. And then the pain reaches a kind of certain level of intensity, and then it begins to dissipate because the need's getting met. She says, "The Lord neither rejects anything nor holds on to it. He washes, He cleanses, He loves, and He waits. Thus should we do also with all fear. Offer it up to the Lord in the second column. Watch it washed and cleaned. This is true of all past lives, all the impregnations, all the vasana." I believe the vasana is just the, I believe that's just the word that's translated as impregnations. It could also be called imprint of karma. It's kind of like the karmic imprint on body and mind that is sitting there waiting to be kind of unlocked and for the karmic cleanup to happen. She says, "We need nothing more to cleanse us from the vasana, from the deep jangles of karma. We need nothing more to cleanse us than our own willingness to offer it to the Lord and to love it and not reject it." In my book, I've got this highlighted, and I've actually got the word offer underlined in red, like it's so important to me. We need nothing more to cleanse us, to cleanse all the karmic need and longing, all the pain, than our own willingness to offer it to the Lord and to love it and not reject it, just as the eternal does. As we pass it on, as we We love it as we pass it on to the Eternals. By not turning away from it, we love it. You don't put it on the altar of the heart just to get rid of it. You do it because that's the step you have to take. You have to face it squarely. You have to put it on the altar of the heart. Let the Eternal get at it. But you can't be sitting there watching your watch. Oh, well, I'll give this 5 minutes and then it's got to be gone. It doesn't work like that. It takes as long as it takes. She says, His love indeed will cleanse all things. You need faith. Sit with that pain when it's there in faith and look up. She says, There is no need for any assistance from another being such as I. And this is a real reminder to us who like to those of us who like to try to figure it out, which I always try this first. Before I do what she's talking about here, first I always try to figure it out. And every time I finally do the right thing, I look back at what I was trying to figure it out, and I say, am I ever going to learn to stop trying to figure it out and just put it on the altar of the heart? And the answer so far is, actually, no, I'm not. But I may one day. I aspire to that. It's kind of like we do our running around with the pace, we do our pacing with the pain. Before we finally get down to it, sit up straight in the presence of the Buddhas, call out for help, and then put it on the altar. Let the Eternal get at it. And then we find, oh, okay, that's what works. And the tremendous relief. It is, as that hymn says, you know, take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. It does feel like a tremendous burden being raised off the heart whenever you do that. By the way, I'll just caution people, don't think there are like big things and little things in here, and that everything you need to do this with, you need to do it with, and big and little don't apply. Some of the things that are the most difficult to do this with, because they are the most painful, are the seemingly little things. The seemingly little things. The things that, when we admit them to ourselves, we think, oh, I'm just being petty. Or, you know, a real trainee wouldn't think that kind of thought. That kind of thing. But it's we're not trying to take the place of the Eternal, but we need to work at being, and we need to work at being as like the Eternal, as much like the Eternal as we can be, as within our human limits. And in this instance, it means that just as the Eternal does not despise anything, so we have to really work to not despise any part of ourselves, any feeling, any thought, any impulse, any past event, not to despise it. You know, of course, not despising it doesn't mean that one just jumps in and repeats a mistake. But if we're despising it, then we're thinking, well, this isn't really worthy of being put on the altar of the heart. The Eternal is not interested in this. The Eternal only loves and does not discriminate. She goes on to say, Indeed, the way in which the ancient Buddhas did this was the right way. All is achieved through the turning of the wheel of the law. And this is she was saying this a lot, especially in the beginning of 77, throughout 77, which is we're in November, maybe just probably the latter part of November here now in the narration, may even be December, and. Her constant advice to us, one of the things she said a lot, was just turn the wheel of the law. And And she really meant, you know, just really give your willingness to the turning of the great circulation, give your willingness to the great circulation, to the process of cleansing and conversion that naturally wishes to happen. Is trying to happen with us. Lend your will, your wish, your longing to that, because it is wholly good. And then the Eternal will take your willingness and make use of it. She says, all is achieved through the way in which a man follows his breath when he meditates. This is not, of course, one way of teaching meditation beginning is to tell people to follow the breath and the inhalation, and even to visualize it kind of going up the back and then visualize it coming down the front of the body to make a complete circle. But the word breath here has to be understood in a deeper sense, and that is that this is a natural movement of the water of the spirit up the back and down to form this natural circulation. That's a natural movement of it. So when you truly meditate, you just lend yourself to that, and you don't need to sit. Once you know how to really meditate, you don't need to sit there following the breath, the physical breath. So she explained about this. She doesn't do it here and in a little way. It's a bit unfortunate because a very literal-minded person might sit there for the next 10 years, you know, focusing on their breathing when they should have let it go, you know, after the first hour and forgot about it. You don't sit there and meditate and focus on your breathing. The only time I would advise doing that is when your concentration is naturally, not non-willfully, naturally drawn for some reason to focus on the breathing. I don't generally have that, but I have had a lot that I've had in my earlier years of meditation. I would sometimes have my attention drawn to my heartbeat, and it happened naturally. I wouldn't be trying to do it, but I would just be something would be helping me meditate by naturally focusing my concentration on my heartbeat for a while. It would always fall away after a while. So if you're given something like that naturally without trying to do it, that's one thing. But don't sit there and huff and puff thinking that that's meditating. As I found one person doing once. And it had to give him a rather hard kick to get him to stop, but he's actually doing something that was, because it was so willful, it was actually really dangerous. So what she means here, spiritually, is just lend your willingness to the natural turning of the wheel of the law that is the natural circulation of the water of the Spirit. You don't have to feel it happening in your body. And it's not just bodily, it's spiritual. Any more than you have to feel love all the time. Just meditate. And I'm going to stop here, but we're only halfway through this chapter. Again, this is one of the most helpful, for me personally, one of the most helpful practical teachings of how to grow lotus blossoms. Because it's talking about something you can actually do. And I guarantee if when you do it, it works. Well, I'll just add one more thing that sometimes some people really naturally know about asking for help, but don't know about this offering. So sometimes people will cry out for help, and I've seen people do this. You know, help, 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 help. And actually not stop crying out for help and actually go on to the next part of the process. Because in this part of the process, you know, you're taking responsibility for yourself. And you're presenting this, you're sitting still with this aspect of yourself that is so painful and presenting it to the Eternal to help you with. And this second column, you have to understand, you have your part to do. You can't do the Eternal's part. Don't try to do the Eternal's part. You have to do your part, though. So don't stop with the asking for help. And like I said, I have known people who at least for a while, you know, cried out for help repeatedly, but actually didn't help themselves in this way. Wouldn't meet the Eternal halfway by making an effort to really sit still with the thing. The Eternal is very good at hearing. You only have to ask once, generally. Then, you know, get on and do the next step. You know, it doesn't hurt to ask more than once most of the time. But don't get stuck at the, you know, crying out for help, you know, and kind of take the position, well, I'm helpless. All I can do is ask for help. So you may feel utterly helpless, but if you want to sit still, nothing can stop you. Sit still. Let the Eternal get at it, at the need. Don't drown the Eternal's help out with cries for help. Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.